May I hand over now to Eva, who will be talking about class action and in particular the European recently introduced equivalent or so to class actions.
Right. Thank you very much for inviting me here. I'm particularly pleased because I've spent very happy years at the Swiss Institute, so it's always very nice to be back. I'm going to talk about a topic which is probably slightly less American, because I want to give you more European perspective on collective redress. I think you all know about class actions. It's probably what you know best about when it comes to the US. And we have experts here like Linda, I mentioned her again, who knows much more about this than I ever would. But what I would like to do is just give you a framework of what happens in the US to show you what actually is currently going on in Europe, which is very interesting. Now, I don't have to remind you what class actions are, but I want to remind you that there are different types of class actions, and what we usually think about or worry about most are the ones on the right, where you actually ask for damages. So injunctive relief is not really a problem, but damages claims have always been in Europe, not so much in the US, obviously, but in Europe it's a bigger issue. Now, what I also would like to remind you about is that the claims that are brought as class actions or collective redress could be of very high value, but they could also be of very low value. And sometimes there isn't enough distinction made between those claims because they might require different treatment. And there have been a lot of claims that have been brought very recently, some of them, antitrust claims, especially investor claims very much, but also all different other types of claims. And you can see here that the last ones obviously are the ones that are low value claims. So there are a couple of situations where you actually have consumers that have been frauded by a business, but they would never go to court for this. So it's minor issue, minor damages, but in this case, class actions can actually be very useful because the case can be brought to court and you can control the behavior of the businesses. So different types of values. Now, also reminding you of the advantages of collective litigation very generally. I think what is often forgotten about by lobbyists is that the original idea of this was to protect the defendant. Because if you have a claim like this, eventually what you get is peace as a defendant. So you had one claim, you don't have to worry about too many claimants coming and bringing you before the courts again. So it's actually time-saving, it's less costly, and you get one judgment or settlement. What is the advantage for the claimants? So here you have what I mentioned before, potentially actions for minor individual damage, but you also have a larger bargaining power because you're together with a group of others who have the same problem, and you, as potentially a consumer, you would never have the power to reach a settlement in an individual case, but you might have it together with the others. And of course, there are issues like third-party funding, distribution of litigation costs, so all sorts of advantages for the claimants. And for the courts, of course, efficiency and prevention of conflicting decisions. And there I always mention a case which I will refer to later, Deutsche Telekom, that is a shareholder claim that has been brought to the German courts. And the judge who dealt with this in the first place was shocked because he had 17,000 investors. And he once came to see us and he said, "This a room like this was filled with files." And he was literally opening the door, closing it, and hoping for help. So this is the situation, and the advantages are obvious. And it's actually, you might wonder why the European states have thought so long about introducing collective redress. So what's interesting as well about the US is, so we mentioned just a couple of things. And one of it is there has been a shift from injunctive to collective redress, to compensatory collective redress. And this has happened, of course, a long time ago in the US, but it's worth mentioning because this is something that we see now currently in Europe. It has never been an issue that you bring injunctions to the courts collectively or as a representative association, for instance, but it has always been an issue to bring damages claims. And in the history of the US, this has started as well, not with compensatory claims, but with injunctions. And what's interesting as well, they started with opt-in and moved to opt-out. And that is also something that we can see currently in Europe. There is this idea that opt-in is much better than opt-out. And this shift from opt-in to opt-out, I will show you later, is happening currently as well in Europe. Now, this just very briefly. So you will all know the specifics of class actions in the US. There's the Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which gives all the details about the admissibility of such actions and the certification criteria. And then, of course, we have the opt-out system, which is subject to certain requirements, as per different cases that you will probably also know from the US. And then the specifics of the US discovery, we mentioned it before, the American rule that each party covers their own costs, contingency fees, which are a huge issue for the Europeans, and then punitive damages. So this is the package that you basically get with the US class actions, and you know probably as well that there have been a lot of critiques from the EU, because the Europeans are not used to this. So they are used to basically two parties going to court. If there is a joinder of parties, that happens sometimes, but that's a very modest joinder, so you wouldn't have thousands of people on one side. So they can't actually imagine how this works. And what is the biggest issue, actually, is potential for abuse. And this is something that is mentioned all the time. It's mentioned by the Commission papers. Abuse by defendants of such actions, because they might actually try to frustrate individual claims, but also abuse by claimants, who might try to find certain litigation tactics to get to a better result, and also, of course, the abuse by attorneys who might actively look for cases because they think they can make a lot of money with them. So those are the main concerns that the Europeans have always raised against those actions. Another issue is the opt-out, constitutional concerns that you might have with it, because here our vision is that you decide yourself that you want to go to court. You can't be in proceedings and you don't actually know about them. And then you have also a bigger issue, the loser pays principle, which is the principle that we normally follow in the European member states, and that is not what the Americans do. So in addition to the fears that there have been and the different points that I mentioned, there's something interesting that happened, because over the last couple of years, it seems that the US have become less attractive as a forum for class actions. Why is that so? You know the Morrison case, of course, and the Morrison case actually cut down significantly the option of F-cubed class actions in the US, meaning, in this case, it has been decided that there wouldn't be any extraterritorial application of US securities laws, so the actual interest why you bring a class action to the US to apply those particular protective provisions. And if those provisions actually can't apply in these cases, it doesn't make much sense to bring a case in the US at all. There have been other restrictions that Andrea mentioned in the beginning, the Class Action Fairness Act, for instance, and other cases. But overall, there is a shift to a more restrictive approach. Now, what does that mean for the Europeans? It means that we need some new strategies here, because some of the cases that could have gone there won't go to the US anymore. And obviously, some of the member states have seized that opportunity or have seen that opportunity already, such as the Netherlands. So the Netherlands are very progressive in their approach. They've been the first, when they heard about the Brexit referendum, to say, we have a commercial court in the Netherlands, please come to us, we do everything in English for you. And that was just days after the referendum result. And they have also a very progressive regime for collective redress. So now what happened in Europe? Basically, we have a real patchwork of different mechanisms that exist across the EU. Injunctive redress is very widespread, so that's not a problem, but compensatory collective redress has slowly developed because of the issues that I mentioned before. So what happened as well is there have been discussions on a European scale at the European Commission, and they have always tried to find a European regime for this. And they've never made it, actually, because there was so much lobbying against collective redress. And what they've done is the creation of a recommendation. That recommendation lists a couple of principles, which I have called class action à l'européenne, so different principles that those regimes in the member states should follow. And they impose certain limits, actually, to prevent all the dangers that potentially come from the class actions in the US. This recommendation is non-binding, but of course the Commission expects it to be more or less binding, so they expect the member states to have done something on the issues. And indeed, there has been some increased activity in the member states. Now, what are these principles? So you can see here that a regime is actually really wanted because the Commission thinks that each member state should put a system in place to protect consumers in the first place. So this introduction of national collective redress regimes is wanted. What they fix is strict requirements for standing, so precise conditions for associations to be able to bring claims. And, of course, it needed to be, they went for an opt-in procedure. And this is a very funny line in the recommendation because it says, this is the principle. Any exception to the principle by law or by court order should be duly justified by reasons of sound administration of justice. Now, some member states have found a very clever way to regulate that, but there has been a little bit of question mark what it actually means. And of course, no punitive damages. We stick to the loser pays principle. We control third-party funding for such claims, and there should be no contingency fees. And the way how it's phrased is there shouldn't be any incentive to litigation that is unnecessary from the point of view of the interest of any of the parties. This is, again, also an issue, especially for associations to bring claims. Now, why do we want collective redress in the EU? I mentioned it already. There are different policy goals behind it. And one of them is, of course, protection of weaker parties, protection of consumers, and also private enforcement of regulatory goals. Now, critiques of the European system. So the major critique is opt-in procedures. If you want opt-in as a principle, it doesn't really work in practice for all types of cases. It might work for high-value claims. So as I mentioned in the beginning, we have different types of claims we have to look at. And for the high-value claims, that actually works potentially well. For low-value claims, it actually doesn't because the costs are far too high to inquire about all the potential claimants. Restrictions of contingency fees, again, there are no incentives for any association to bring a claim. There are financial risks because they have to prepare a lot of things and invest their time, but they won't actually necessarily get anything back, and it's not really interesting for the lawyers either. And another issue, and that hasn't been properly sorted out, is the Commission wants foreign claimants to be able to join collective redress proceedings in other member states. But there are no rules on private international law that support that. So there are no rules that basically create concentration of claims in one forum other than the defendant's domicile. And that's a bigger issue that needs to be looked at. Now, very briefly, what types of mechanisms do we have in the member states? And there are general mechanisms that cover all sorts of areas, and there are also sector or mostly sector-specific mechanisms, which, for instance, provide for a regime in competition law or for investor claims or for certain consumer claims. Now, the types of procedures are very different. So it's a real patchwork in Europe. You have either the injunctive side, so representative actions, which most countries have, and then you have different types of collective claims from group litigation orders to settlements. The interesting thing is that there are more and more group action proceedings introduced at the moment, so proper collective proceedings. And there are also interesting ways of getting to a similar result by assignment of claims or by test case proceedings. And that I will show you a little bit more in detail. What can be noted, and that's interesting as well, although the Commission wants opt-in mechanisms, the different member states who have recently regulated this area, they actually said, well, we go for both options. We leave it in the option of a court to decide whether that case should be opt-in or it should be opt-out. That complies with the wording of the recommendation, And it leaves the door open to actually decide, do I have a high-value case or do I have a low-value case, and what works better in practice. And there you can see this in Belgium, for instance, in Denmark. You can also see in Slovenia new draft legislation that this idea is actually taken on by the national legislators. So that's quite an interesting concept. And I think that will probably be the best way forward anyway, because you can decide case by case which system works. Then there's also a big shift now to compensatory collective redress, so introduction of all these different mechanisms. And we have a lot of activity recently from France to Belgium to the UK, where group actions have been introduced, which focus on damages. Now, of course, those actions stick to the principles that we've seen before. So no contingency fees, no punitive damages, restrictions on funding, so control of funders, and that mix of opt-in and opt-out, or only opt-in depending on the country. So you see here several countries have been working on the introduction of group actions very recently. I give you one example, which is the UK. So there they introduced damages actions for consumers and SMEs against competition law infringements. And there's the famous MasterCard case, which there are actually several MasterCard cases, but this one here is a proper class action that has been brought by consumers, and there have been other cases running by retailers against MasterCard. So one by Sainsbury's that has been decided positively, and one by other retailers that has been rejected. So what are the different requirements? And you can see here similar things that you know from the US, combined with all those protective ideas that the Commission has mentioned in the recommendation. So no punitive damages, no damage-based agreements, and so on. Possibility of settlement in those proceedings, which is very important as well in most of the countries that have recently introduced legislation. Now, another model is to allow test case proceedings. And that has happened in Germany in investor disputes. I mentioned the poor judge who was facing those 17,000 files. So actually for him, the legislator has created this regime because they've realized he can't manage and there needs to be something. So they introduced this Test Case Proceedings Act called CAPMUC. And so this is limited to investor claims. So the case that was at issue, which was the Deutsche Telekom case, so a case concerning 17,000 shareholders of the German telecommunications business. And what happens is you need 10 claimants as a minimum to bring such a case. The court selects a lead plaintiff. This case runs through. And then once the core issues of liability are decided, that issue is binding actually for all the other claimants. And then you can, in the end, decide on the amount of damages individually in each case. This sounds all very nice. The problem is this case has been running now for 16 years. It has been decided in 2016 by the Higher Regional Court of Frankfurt. In the meantime, the lead plaintiff died, so he won't have any benefit of this. And the judge actually was a bit frustrated because she said this case is anyway going to the Supreme Court. So the decision was in favor of the investors, but it took 16 years. And it will still continue. So it's good in principle, but the duration in practice is quite impressive. And then we also have the Volkswagen issue. So a lot of shareholders have actually tried to sue Volkswagen in class actions. And this one is an investor claim that is brought by Quinn Emanuel in Germany. And the claimants are actually from the US. So it's quite an interesting case, and the German lawyers are really in fighting spirit to fight this case through against Volkswagen. Then another interesting model how to reach a good result in terms of damages has been tested by Cartel Damages Claims. That's a company who actually specializes in those claims, and they bring those claims or have brought those claims in different jurisdictions. So what happened is they have been assigned high-value antitrust claims. They've bundled those claims, they went to the court, and they've tried to fight those claims through. They have been successful in the Netherlands and in Finland. They haven't been successful in Germany, but for more or less formal reasons. They haven't observed certain rules before they actually made the assignments, and they haven't observed requirements as to funding, because the German courts say, if you want to do this, then you need to ensure funding from the very beginning, not only when you go to court, but already at the moment when you get those different assignments. So you need to make sure that at that moment you can already guarantee that you will be able to fund such a claim and cover the potential costs, which obviously CDC wasn't very happy about and said we don't actually understand why we were able to cover all those costs, why it depends on that particular moment in time. We don't know, and they complained about the too dogmatic approach of the German courts, and they were very happy in the Netherlands. And coming to the Netherlands, so they have a very interesting system which has been working for a while, which is collective settlements. So what they are doing is an association is created which actually negotiates with the defendant, and they agree on a settlement that's out-of-court settlement. This settlement then needs to be declared binding by the court in Amsterdam. It's the Amsterdam Court of Appeal. They assess the arrangements, and if they think this is reasonable, they will declare it binding, and then it will have effect on all the participants. This mechanism was actually meant for national cases, but has been extended to cross-border cases, and the Dutch have seen that this is actually an opportunity for business. So like with Brexit, that's another opportunity, and they've already used it reasonably well. There has been one case called Converium, which involved a Swiss insurance as well. And what happened in this case was that there was no option basically to join class actions in the US. A settlement has been reached in the Netherlands. That settlement would have had to be declared binding and was declared binding. The problem was just, and that brings us back to what I said in the beginning, it's actually very difficult to get jurisdiction in those cases. If you have many different participants, claimants from different countries, because the problem is, it's the Amsterdam court who needs jurisdiction, and we only had 200 purchases of those shares that were Dutch out of 12,000 in total. There was a Dutch foundation involved, but actually there weren't very strong links to the Netherlands. And the question was, how on earth do we get jurisdiction to actually declare that settlement binding? And they had to use a trick that nobody ever complained about, but it's not very logic and it's not very, let's say, Andrea would probably not be very happy about it. So they have applied a provision that is made for a concentration of claims when you have several defendants. So when you want to sue, for instance, against members of a cartel, this provision allows you to sue at the domicile of one of those defendants. Now, of course, here we talk about claimants. So how can you apply this to the side of the claimants? And they came up with a sort of idea that because this is a settlement procedure, it doesn't really matter. So the claimants are also defendants because the settlement sort of has effect against them, so we can actually use this provision. It works because nobody complains about it, but it shows you that there is something wrong, because those provisions actually would need to be adapted to the situation that we have at the moment. So just to finish, is there a sort of competition between the EU and the US? I would say yes, because there's a lot of activity, as you see, going on at the moment. And there is this tendency in the US to have a more restrictive approach as to which types of claims can actually go there. And a more aggressive approach of European jurisdictions to actually take on some work that they are able to take on. Of course, there will be cases that can only go to the US and cases that can only go to Europe, but there will still be some sort of overlap, more at least than there was before. The only problem is that in Europe we still have to work on a couple of issues to make the whole system work. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this very broad and complete overview of what is happening in Europe in this field. We see that, well, we often criticize Americans, but we also very often follow Americans' ideas, and I think it's interesting to see what we will do out of these ideas in European countries, what we are doing now.